5 minutes. Let me announce the more present speakers. Today we have Ferro from Hamilton College, and he is going to tell us about collapse models.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. What is this? I'm going to talk about two pieces of work that I've done this last year, which I hope you'll find interesting. Talk will be organized the following way. First, in case I did give a talk last year around this time on collapse models, but in case you either weren't here or don't remember the equations, I'm going to give you an introduction to the subject. That's the first thing I'll talk about. The collapse model I call continuous spontaneous localization model, which is a mouthful, so CSL is what I'll call it. And roughly speaking, what's being done is a term is added to Schrodinger's equation, which depends on a randomly fluctuating field. And as a result, the evolution of the state vector is that when you get a superposition of macroscopically distinguishable states, when the state vector, for example, following a measurement, will give you such a thing, the dynamics collapses the state vector, that is, it evolves so that you end up with essentially one of the states, which is one of the states or the other state. And depending upon which the fluctuating field is allowed, is a white noise class, so it can be anything. And depending upon what the white noise field is, specifically what the function of time it is, you'll get one result or the other, and you'll get it with the probabilities the quantum mechanics gives you. So the first thing I'm going to do is discuss that formalism. And then I'm going to discuss these two pieces of work that I've done. First one is called completely quantized collapse. And actually, this was begun when I gave my talk last year. At the end of my talk, Rob Speckens asked a question. And it was essentially, can't you do this collapse stuff totally quantum mechanically in some way? It wasn't, he asked a better question, John. Crazy my idea. And I said, I didn't give the right answer. Essentially, it's, yes, you could, but you'd have to do something pretty much like what I'm doing. But what I should have said was, 10 years ago, I did it. And I just had forgotten, really, that I did it 10 years ago. And so I tried it out again and looked it over and saw if I could do it better. And then I saw that I could use it to answer some questions. It was an interesting formalism, and I could answer some questions because it could stand in quantum mechanics that I hadn't answered before, and even ask some questions that I hadn't asked before. And so what I'm going to do is discuss three topics which come out. First, I'm going to discuss this completely quantized collapse model and how it works. And then I'm going to discuss energy conservation. When I first arrived at these collapse models, even before the model that I'm going to be talking about, which I think is very nice, when I first started working on this, I realized that if you have wave function collapse taking place, it narrows wave packets. When it narrows wave packets, it means it gives particles energy. So one of the consequences of this theory is that an electron in an atom, for example, will be knocked out of the atom. Very slow rate, but will be knocked out of the atom. And similarly, a nucleon will be knocked out of the nucleus. And that's lack of energy conservation. Where does the energy come from to supply this? Well, there is this randomly fluctuating field, but it's a classical field. And I would wave my hands and say, well, it must come from this field, this fluctuating field. But I didn't have any expression for the energy that's in this field. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I finally found, laboriously, a way to define an energy, which actually would be the same definition as up to this time. And I managed to prove that the expectation value of the energy is conserved. That is to say, I was able to assign an energy to this fluctuating field, and the expectation value of the energy was conserved. But to say that the first moment of an energy is constant is not to say that energy is conserved. You need all moments to be constant. And so with this formalism, I could prove that, in fact, that energy is totally conserved. Second thing is that I'm able to define a time operator. The reason for that is that the energy of this field, it's a white noise field when I quantize it, and it has all energies, positive and negative energies. And when you have a Hamiltonian, which is unbounded, my gosh, I mean, it's just crying, like the Matterhorn cries to define, it's crying to define a time operator. The semi-bounded Hamiltonian, you can define a time operator also. For example, there's a famous time operator between Bohm and Harloff, which is the arrival time operator, which is m x times 1 over p plus 1 over p times x, and it's conjugate with p squared over 2m. And this operator is symmetric, that is, its transpose complex conjugate is equal to itself, but it's not self-adjoint, because its domain is not equal to its range. And as a result, you have eigenvalues, but the eigenfunctions are not orthogonal, and that gives you a real mess. Well, here you have a perfectly nice unbounded Hamiltonian, and so you can define a time operator. Now, not just because it's there that I want to define a time operator, but I've always had a feeling that time somehow ought to be related to collapse. And this is kind of the beginning of that. That is to say, if you don't have collapse, you don't have events taking place. And if you don't have events taking place, you don't have time. Time doesn't, nothing's happening, nothing's evolving. So I've always felt that there ought to be some kind of relationship. And so I was interested to see what this time operator was. Then finally, one of the major problems in collapse models, or this collapse model for me, is it's a phenomenological model. I don't say what this fluctuating field is. What is it physically? It would be nice to be able to say that to relate this fluctuating field to something physical. And because I have a completely quantized collapse model, and most people work with physical things that are quantized, it seems to be a promising place to promising formalism whereby one could, in fact, find something physical that is quantized and replace this, what you'll see is this quantized fluctuating white noise field by it. I'm going to give two models. One of them is essentially a collection of quantum fields. The models that I'm giving are not physically plausible, but they kind of show some of the things that are needed. One of them will be a collection of quantized fields. The other one will be, it's a collection of spins. It's sort of a spin network seen in a nightmare, as well as a combination of that and paper I once wrote with Moon's Flyers about a semi-classical gravitational model for collapse. So that's the topics that will be in this paper. I hope I have time for the next paper, which is a quasi-relativistic model. I've been working for 10 years, more than 10 years now, on trying to find a relativistic collapse model, and I haven't been able to find the one that one can be happy with. So I want to first discuss what's wrong, what goes wrong with these models in a very brief way, and then I'll give you what I call quasi-relativistic model, which is the best I can do, and it does have a very nice positive aspect to it that it doesn't disagree with the experiment. Okay, so that's the program of the talk, these two papers. So the first thing is, I want to discuss the collapse model and how it works. And I'll call this the CSL Lite, because it's not the full CSL model which I can apply to any physical situation. It's one that shows the mathematical structure of the collapse models. But in fact, most of the discussion will be involving CSL-Lite because for most, but not all, of the first paper's talks, because the mathematical equations are simpler. I'll just simply show it to you. Here's a state vector in the Schrodinger picture, which depends upon W of t. Wt is a function of time. You put any function of time you want to of white noise class, and you're going to get an evolution. And this equation tells you the evolution. Lambda is a parameter which gives you the collapse rate. And capital A is an operator. And as I will show you shortly, this equation, when h is equal to 0, as time goes to infinity, you'll get collapsed to one of the eigenstates of the operator A with the probabilities that quantum mechanics of collapse rule will give you. So you can put any function of time in here that you like, and you'll get a state vector out of it. But you need another part of the statement of the theory, beside the evolution equation, what's the probability that nature gives you that W? After all, if nature, if you can put any W you like, but if nature says it, the probability is zero of that occurring, then you might as well not even think about it. Well, the probability is very simple. It is that the that simply this is a non-unitary evolution. This part is unitary, but this part is not. So the squared norm of the state vector changes, and here's the squared norm of the state vector, and this says that if you have the squared norm of the state vector is large, that's a probable W, and if it's small, it's an improbable W. And for the purposes of calculation, when you take the scalar product here, this is an integral over time. You make this a sum, so multiply by dt and w of tj, and then each w can go from minus infinity to plus infinity. It's an independent variable. And this is white noise. And so this is what the integration is. So that's it. That's the whole statement. All you have to do is calculations and see what the predictions are. So let me show you how this works.
We're here. So you have to decide ahead of time in which eigenstates.
Yes, you have to decide what your operator A is. The physics is in the operator A. For example, if you wanted to collapse the position eigenstates, you would make this, in this simple example, X, the position operator. If you want to collapse the momentum operator, whatever you want to collapse it to. So this is not yet the full statement of the physical theory because the choice in A is important.
Just one question. This probability of W is not sort of...
It's a probability density.
Probably, it's not sort of universal. It depends on what's happened in the past. Is that right? Because there is...
Yes, yes. It's the state vector at time t. This is the probability at time t that that W... and so it depends upon the whole history of the W.
Yeah.
Exactly, because this depends upon the whole history of the W. So it is truly a probability of the whole W, not just the W at a particular instance of time. So how does it work?
Okay.
So let's set the Hamiltonian equal to zero. Let's let the initial state be a superposition of eigenstates of the operator A, certain coefficients. And then if you just plug this in to the right-hand side of the previous equation, this is what you get for the state vector evolution. And this is what you get for the probability. So there you are. Now, let me give you an example. It's a very simple example. Suppose W doesn't in fact depend upon T, but it happens to be 2 lambda times A sub 1, which is a very special choice. Well, if you put 2 lambda A sub 1 into here, then this is a constant, and you can integrate with respect to time. For the first term, the integrand is 0, so you just get alpha 1 A 1. But for all the rest, this is what you get. And you can see, as time goes to infinity, that this term gets smaller and smaller, and you end up with alpha 1 A 1 for this particular W. And the probability, similarly, you can see that when you calculate the probability density, the first term survives, and the rest of the terms do not. Of course, this isn't the probability, because that's just one particular W. And so one really wants a statement, this is a very simple example, one wants a statement for the for general kinds of fluctuating fields, Ws. So I'm not going to prove this here, but it's not hard to prove that more generally, consider any fluctuating field W which fluctuates around the value 2 lambda A, where A can be any number at all. Okay? So this is the time average of the W field as t goes to infinity. It's got to be some value, except for that set of measures 0, which never does converge. If A is not equal to A sub n, so this W is this randomly fluctuating thing, which averages out to 0, times 2 lambda A, this actually goes to 0 as time goes to infinity. What happens is you get A is not equal to A sub n, so every little bit of delta t, no matter what the W0 is doing, gives you a little bit more contribution to the numerator here until it ends up being 0. But if A equals A sub m, then one of the A's, if the two A's are the same, you in fact, when you write W is equal to this fluctuating thing, W0 plus 2 lambda A sub m, you get the integral over W0, and you integrate over all possible values of that W0, which fluctuates, so its average is 0, you get the Kronecker delta. And so what this means is if W is one of those fluctuating fields, which is two people, time averages two lambda A, where A is not equal to one of the ANs, you'll get something here which goes to zero. The state vector goes to zero, but the probability of it goes to zero as well, so who cares about it? If it's equal to one of the A sub Ns, then you get an integral over this time averaging zero fluctuating field squared, and when you integrate this probability over all W, you'll just get this contribution, the absolute magnitude of alpha n squared, and all the other terms will go to zero except the one term, some term with some coefficient, which is proportional to A sub n. So that's how it works. You can get collapse. Now, here's a little bit of formalism which I'm going to need for what I'm going to discuss later. The Schrodinger equation, you can take the time derivative of the equation I wrote down, the evolution equation, and this becomes the modified Schrodinger equation. This is the usual part, and this is the extra part that's there. And I'm going to be working mostly in the interaction picture, in which the interaction picture state vector is dpi ht times the Schrodinger picture. And if I define the operator A of t as a unitary transformation of A, this is what, in the interaction picture, the evolution looks like. And that's, it's nice to have because I don't have the H hanging out there, and the equations look simpler. The density matrix. The density matrix is the integral of the probability, which is this, times the pure states, but normalized to 1. So when you normalize them, you have to, when you take the projection operator on the state here, you have to divide by the norm squared, and this cancels with this PTW. And so, in fact, what you've got is a Gaussian integral that you can do, writing in what psi of TW is. It's this acting on phi, and similarly on this side. This becomes a sum of Gaussian integrals. Each W of t is separately integrated over, and when you integrate over W, what you get is the differences of the mean squared divided by the sum of the variances. And if you just go ahead and do that, this is what you get. And you'll notice I put an L here and an R here on the operators, AL and AR. This is a time ordered, and this is time reverse ordered. And L means that the operator A is to the left of this initial density matrix, that's just rho of zero, and AR means it's to the right. So when I get done with this integral, I have a time ordering. The time ordering means that AL is time ordered, but AR is time reverse ordered. And when you expand this in a power series, the AL should be the left and the AR to the right, and the time ordering takes care of where they should be, and so that's very nice compact notation. If you take the derivative of rho with respect to t, you get this equation over here, which is a special form of the Lindblad equation. For example, suppose your initial state vector, rho of 0, is what we talked about earlier, the example I gave before, maybe the state vector is this sum over here. Then, according to this equation here, this is time independence, you can do the integral, rho of t is this, and you can very easily see how the off-diagonal elements, if n is not equal to m, and the a's, I'm assuming they're all distinct, how the off-diagonal elements decays to zero, and the on-diagonal elements keep their values, their probabilities, as the absolute magnitude squared of the initial values. Okay, so that's a bit of the formalism. And now I want to point out that suppose you have many a's. I have many A's, many operators, each of which are mutually commuting with each other. So the eigenstates are joint eigenstates of all these operators. Then you have to define the state vector evolution with many W's, many fluctuating fields, one for each of these operators. And then everything goes through as before. The density matrix here would be the sum of all the differences of eigenvalues squared for all the operators. So that the more differences there are between operators, the faster the collapse takes place. Finally, although as I say, I'm going to do most of this with CSL light, let me just briefly, because I will do something about this at some point, give you what I'll call full-blown CSL. That is the theory which is there to confront the experiment. And so far, there's no experiment which has shown that this is not correct. It is essentially replacing the time integral by a space-time integral. The W function of t, the fluctuating field, is a white noise function of space and time. It can be different at each point of space or each point of time. That is to say, this is just like the example I gave you earlier of many different a's. So the W at different positions are the many different a's. And this is lambda is the collapse parameter, a certain amount of time, and I'll say in a moment what it is. And the A operator is specifically chosen. So that this, then now this is the physical theory. It's roughly speaking, represents the operator which gives the number of particles in a sphere of radius 10 to the minus 5 centimeters around the point x. That's what the operator A represents. Formally, you can write it this way. This is a Gaussian, which is essentially 1, when the difference between this is the particle number density operator. This is the creation and annihilation operators for particles of type S, S being electrons or neutrons or protons or pions or whatever you want. This is the mass of the particle. So this is proportional to the mass operator in a volume of 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. This is roughly 1 when x is within that radius and roughly 0 when x is outside of that radius. This owes a great debt to Girardi, Rimini, and Weber's spontaneous localization model, which I did homage by naming this continuous spontaneous localization. They chose numbers which are just ad hoc parameters, 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, and the characteristic time of collapse they chose is 10 to the 16 seconds, which comes down to 300 million years. There are now experiments which restrict the range of the parameters. They can't just be anything. But these numbers are still within the allowed range, and I see no reason to change right now. If the state vector is an initial superposition of, so here's an example, of a neutron to the left plus a state where the neutron is to the right, there's very small mass density here, so this sum is very small, and the collapse time for a single neutron, because this m0 is the mass of the neutron, so this number is just 1, is lambda, and is the rate, and the collapse time is 10 to the 16 seconds, which is a very long time, so that neutron interference experiment would not be affected by this. Yeah?
Can I get to the time dependence in A?
Sorry, it should be. Thank you. A of xt here is the unitarily transient, either iht A of x, either minus iht. And this is the operator before I go to the interaction picture. In the Schrodinger picture, I have a minus iht here, and this would be A of x. Okay, thanks very much. But if you had a pointer, superposition of a pointer here plus a pointer there, then if the pointer is very small, that is smaller than 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, then the collapse time is 10 to the 16th over the number squared of nucleons in that pointer. And so that can be quite small, just a relatively small number, 10 to the 10th or something like that, nucleons, which is really a very small number of nucleons. For a larger size pointer, the formula isn't quite so simple. So I finish now with my first thing that I wanted to do in this talk, which is present to you CSL. And now I'm going to talk about completely quantized collapse. That is, quantizing the collapse model, which I call CSL-like, so that the fluctuating field is no longer a classical function of time, but is represented by an operator. So that's the idea, how the C number WT become a quantized operator. So I'm going to define an operator. This, by the way, owes there are people like Hudson and Parsarathy and in the early 90s, and Accardi also, and other people have worked on quantized white noise. I'm using this, though, in a way that they haven't used it, and I'm using it for my own nefarious purposes. So we'll define, for example, well, we'll define the operator WT in terms of creation annihilation operators for quanta of the W field, which will obey the usual commutation relations. And I'm going to define a conjugate field as well over here. And what's interesting is this field commutes with itself at all times. Now that's something that you usually don't see with quantized fields, but the reason for it is you have the negative frequencies are represented as equally as the positive frequencies. For example, if you make it consider a tachyon quantized field, since its positive energies and negative energies structures are the same, it too can commute with itself at all times and all positions. And similarly, the conjugate field is the same, but these two fields don't commute with each other. You can think of W and T, it's best to think of it at discrete times rather than continuous time, and then the limit of discrete time becoming continuous. You have the joint eigenstate of this operator at any time T, and it's a classical function of W and T. So these states then are each labeled by a classical white noise, and they're an eigenstate of capital W of T. And for each time, that's a way of looking at the eigenstate of W for all times. The vacuum state is, of course, annihilated by B, which means if you just eliminate the B dagger from these equations, you get this differential equation for the vacuum expressed in the basis of eigenstates of capital W, and you integrate it and you get this, and this may start to look familiar to you because this is the minus 1 over 4 lambda integral of W squared that you saw in CSL, and you can do the same thing for pi if you want to. Now, I'm going to define the evolution as the time-ordered product of this interaction, the interaction of the operator A with pi. Now pi, what pi is the conjugate momentum to W, so it's represented essentially by the derivative with respect to W, which means it's the translation operator. So when this acts on the initial state, which is the vacuum state for W multiplied by the particle state, which I'm calling phi here, it simply translates the W by 2 lambda A. And lo and behold, this piece of it is, in fact, the CSL evolution, but there's a little bit more because this interaction is only over 0 to t, so from minus infinity to 0 and from t to infinity, you just get the, if you will, the part of the vacuum state that corresponds to times that have not yet been seen or not yet been involved. So that is completely quantized collapse, and let me say something about it. Because there are no other people who might object. Professor Girardi said to me, I'm going against everything I ever stood for when I did this, because I used to rail against there being superpositions of states, that you wanted to know what the reality was, you want to know what the reals were. I'm not going against everything that I ever stood for, because what I've always wanted to know is a clean set of rules for defining what are the realizable states in nature and what are the probabilities of those states. And I think that most interpretations, and that I know no other interpretation but this, and both Bolden's mechanics give you this such a well-defined statement. Consider the state vector. Now, this, by the way, is a state vector in the particle space. It is a scalar product in the W space, but it's a state vector in the particle space. And in fact, just writing it out in words, this is the CSL state vector. So if you expand the state vector in the W basis, what you've got is a direct product, a Schmidt decomposition, a direct product in this basis of eigenstates of W and the CSL states. And the statement, the clean statement of what the realizable states in CSL always have been, every W, every fluctuating field gives you a realizable state, period. And the probabilities are the ones according to the probability rule. And so here I have the same simple description. Every state multiplying, so these are, if you will, preferred basis states, but they're well-defined preferred basis states. Every single state is a fiscal state. And they are good fiscal states because we get a macroscopic superposition in one of those states, it doesn't last long, it becomes one or the other state. So these are perfectly good fiscal states, they're what you see around you. The usual probability rule is the same as the CSL probability rule, except for this extra piece here, these extra W's, and you can just integrate over them because they don't play any role, and so in fact the probability rule is exactly the same as the CSL probability rule. And with this, this is a super selection kind of behavior because these states never interfere. They're all orthogonal. Each state evolves separately into other states. So this is perhaps a prime example. Well, I like to say that all interpretations will work with this. The many worlds interpretation works fine because this defines what the worlds are. There's a new single world for every W. Consistent histories, I know Adrian wrote a nice paper showing how you could use the GRW model to do something like this, to define consistent histories in a well-defined way. And consistent histories work fine, which means things as a history. And if you want environmental decoherence, as long as you regard that as the environment, to trace over it, you've got environmental decoherence. So, now, this is completely quantized collapse. And let me just say a little bit more about it, trying to give you some kind of insight, because in fact, the original people who worked at this kind of formalism were discussing continuous measurements. And so you can regard this as continuous measurement. For over a little time interval dt, this is the only thing that changes. And this is like a pointer wave function. If you think of a W as being a pointer, it has a Gaussian distribution around zero. The pointer's average value is zero. Of course, its width is very large. It's 4 lambda over dt. So it's a pointer with a very great uncertainty, but still it's a pointer. And this change with time is just the standard von Neumann measurement behavior. That is, the pointer on average moves over to 2 lambda a. So for CQC light, you can imagine that that there's a whole bunch of pointers waiting over each little time interval delta t, waiting to get involved. And in a measurement, and they make the measurement up to time t, and these pointers are waiting to measure, and these pointers will never measure. And for full-blown CQC, where you have space and time, all these pointers from time zero over all space up to time t get involved in a measurement, and these pointers are waiting to measure things. So this is a way of looking at this formalism. Okay, so having now told you about this formalism, I now want to show you that it's useful. It's a thing that you can familiarly calculate things. So I'm going to begin with my first exercise in utilizing this formalism. The W field energy is this. This is what you'd expect. If you put it in terms of the W and pi fields, it's the time derivative of W times pi. It doesn't matter what the order is because they can do that as this integral under this integral ratio. They don't do it, but under the integral ratio. This generates the time translation of W and pi in a fine way. And now, we've been talking about the interaction picture. So let me now go backwards to the Schrodinger picture. What's normally called Schrodinger picture, but perhaps shouldn't here be called Schrodinger picture. It's multiplying by the e to the minus I, the Hamiltonian associated with the particles times t. And of course, that converts the state vector, which before was this, with an. Oh, what's happening here?
It's also
the way. Oh, okay, I can't move things. Has that been doing horrible things like this all along? This was an A of T, it's now not an A of T, but there's an AJ there. And let's go all the way to what I call the sub-Schrodinger picture, that is multiplied by e to the minus I HWT, and then the interaction doesn't depend upon time at all, and this is what you get, and that's an ordinary Hamiltonian evolution. So this is the conserved energy. And so one can calculate this. For example, for CSL Life, that is to say the example I've been giving you, QCSL Life, what I'm talking about is the energy associated with the ensemble of evolutions, by the way. Not any particular evolution, but the ensemble of evolutions. This is generally true when you use ordinary quantum mechanics in the collapse postulate. You don't necessarily conserve energy during an individual collapse, but the ensemble will, in many cases, not all cases, actually conserve energy. But here, this is energy associated with the ensemble. So again, the example, HA is zero in the initial state. Here you can make the generating function for H, and this is the generating function, and then the Fourier transform will be the probability distribution of the energy. Similarly, HW generating function, the generating function for the energy associated with the fluctuating field, that this isn't time dependent because the energy is conserved, but this is time dependent. And when you find the probability distribution for the total energy, this is the expression for it. And you'll notice that E can be negative as well as positive. And that's not surprising because, after all, there is that the total energy includes not only the particles with positive energy, but the fluctuating field, which has negative and positive energy. HW probability density is time dependent, as I said. At T equals zero, you start out with the energy equals zero. At T equals zero, this term vanishes. This term cancels this one. This term vanishes, and one simply has this is one, and this simply has delta of E. The energy is zero. But as time goes on, these terms go away, and one ends up with this. And there is no mistake. This two is here, and there is no two here. One cannot say that all the energy becomes the field. The fluctuating field energy, the H is distinctly different from HW, and so their energy distribution is, the asymptotic energy distribution of that is not the same as that. Let me just give you another example of the use of this before I move on to the time operator. Here's an example, CSL light and HA not equal to zero, the thing I labored so hard to prove about 4 or 5 years ago. I got an expectation value for HA, I got an expectation value for HW, they are not the same, and the interaction energy expectation value is zero, but the time derivative of them is the same. For example, for a free particle collapsed into position eigenstates, it's simple to calculate these two. The expectation for HA is this, and it increases with time, as you'd expect, because when you collapse the position eigenstates, you narrow the wave functions, therefore you're giving particles energy. This is a single free particle, you're giving the free particle energy, and it increases with time. And the expectation value of HW is the negative of the time derivative of these two are negative to each other. And you can calculate the asymptotic probability distribution of HW. And it's a complicated expression, but the thing I want you to focus on is this, which when you take the average, it turns out this is the average. That is to say, this is HW average. It's a negative number. The energy is displaced over in the negative direction because of the increase in energy of the particles. So it all makes good physical sense. So I can now finally say to the world that energy is conserved in collapse models, and the energy of the particles is compensated for by the energy of the fluctuating field. The next thing I want to talk about is the time operator. As I said, it's there. And you can easily write it down, the operator, which commutes with the Hamiltonian to UI. And this is the particle number operator. And this thing in the numerator here looks very much like what energies usually look like. It is positive definite, but it multiplies time. Here, the eigenfunctions are Hermite polynomials of W at various times. That's by discretized time. This W is the product of eigenstates, like position eigenstates, but they're W eigenstates at various times. And the eigenvalues have this kind of center of time form. And the mean of the time operator is given by this rather complicated expression, but let's take some examples. When the Hamiltonian is zero, so these A's don't depend upon time, this becomes one, this exponentially decays, this is the one that's essentially k, the a's in the numerator and denominator here cancel, and what's left here is this time, the average value of time over time. And that's t over 2. I wish it was t, but it's not. It's t over 2. And that's why the uncertainty, fractional uncertainty, does go down as 1 over t. However, if the Hamiltonian is not zero, and it is something which makes a of t grow as a power of t to the s, then you can put that in here, and asymptotically you get something that's almost equal to 2. And the uncertainty goes down even faster. Now, in full-blown CSL, where you get, just change all these time integrals to space-time integrals, that's all you need to do, and then it's full-blown CSL. So what's being averaged here is time averaged over, essentially, mass density for fluxing molecule. That is, you're integrating over all space, and you're integrating over a range of time, and you're taking the square of the mass density. It's the average of the time weighted by the square of the mass density. And that means if matter is clumping at a rapid rate, that's like making S here very big. And as a result, the time operator will almost, the expectation value of the time operator, will almost be equal to T. So, so T bar is T over 2 simply because wave function collapse exists. But if there is a lot of clumping, so most recent clumping is more matter is more clumped now than it was in the past, sufficiently log 3, the time average time rate will be approximately equal to t because of gravitational collapse. I don't know what more to do with this now, but I feel there is more that can be done with this. Okay, my third thing that I want to talk about is modeling the fluctuating field. That is to say, I'd like to be able to come up with quantized entities which are not just simply, here's the fluctuating field, WT, but something that's more familiar from other areas of physics, with the hope that, that eventually someone will be able to come up with an actual quantized model for W of T that is really something physically that's there, like gravitational fluctuations of some kind of other. Okay, so here's my first example. Suppose I have a collection of quantum fields. They each have Planck mass m, and each interacts over a short time through Planck time. And the reason I have a Planck mass m there is because I take the standard expression for a quantum field, but if m is the Planck mass, it's so large compared to all the momenta of all the particles that you see around you that you might as well replace e by the square root of m. And that's really what I need. So that's Planck mass seems to be a nice mass to choose that would do that. So this is a standard quantum field, and this is a standard conjugate field, but it's only supposed to interact over a very short time, the Planck time, and I have a subscript t here, meaning that it interacts between t and t plus tau. And then I haven't told you what the constant c is here, but when I calculate the vacuum state in the eigenstate of in the basis of eigenstates of phi t, this is what you get, and I want my 1 over 4 lambda times this little bit of time, times delta t, which is the Planck time there, so I choose c in this particular way. And then if I want the vacuum for all of the quantum fields in the basis, which is the direct product of all of their individual bases, I will get this expression, which is approximately equal to completely quantized collapsed vacuum expression, to a very good approximation, because this tau is what I'm calling dt here. I define the interaction over the short time interval of this field, phi of t, with its phi of t interacting with the a of xt over a very short time interval, and that's what it's equal to. And then I can calculate the state vector at time t, do all these interactions with each of these little fields, each of these fields for these little short times, and what you end up with is essentially, well, you end up with the completely quantized collapse expression where you identify W of xt with yt and pi and of xt of this completing quantized elapsed model is m times this quantity. So that's my first example. The lesson to be taken is you need a structure. You see, if you have just a single quantum field, the problem with it is it's correlated at later times. You can start it out at a certain time, but it's correlated at later times. You want a field, you want fields which are uncorrelated at each instant of time. So that's why I need a different field at each time. The second model I have, which hope then network people will not be insulted by this, involves a collection of spins. And so this is kind of wild. But I'm imagining little volumes, each of the Planck size, so 10 to minus 32 centimeters side, and each of them contains a spin 1/2 particle, but there's a mass associated with that spin 1/2 particle, plus m or minus m, and sigma zm is the mass that it has. And what I'm supposing is that these spins are stuck in this network, but occasionally a few of them break loose. And actually more than that, they break loose with a certain probability, which I'll write down the expression for a moment, certain probability, and interact. And they interact with two things. They interact with a thermal bath of temperature beta inverse, and they interact gravitationally, and put that in quotes. I imagine that where the a spin is, it's surrounded, imagine it's surrounded by a sphere of radius A, which is the Girardi or Meany Weber radius A, and a certain number of particles inside of that. And I imagine those particles smeared uniformly. I can't do this better, but it's the simplest way to think of it. Smeared uniformly around the sphere. Then the mass density inside the sphere, I'm calling rho of xn. This is just like the A, essentially. It's the A of the collapse models. It's the mass density within the sphere. And so the amount of mass in the sphere is rho times a cubed, and up to some constant here, the gravitational interaction is 1 over a times this. And that's the Hamiltonian of interaction there. I'm considering a volume delta v, which is large compared to the Planck volume, and a time interval delta t, which is large compared to the Planck time, and capital N spins will be, on average, excited during this time, and define a probability p as the probability that it will be excited. Of course, it should be a very small number. That is the probability that one will be excited in one cell. So set delta v equal L cubed and delta t equal tau, you get p. But there will be capital N excited in this larger volume. And what I'm going to identify W with eventually, just to see where I'm going, as the sum of the spins inside a volume delta v surrounding the point x and time interval delta t surrounding the point t, the mean value of those spins. That's how I'm going to identify W. The state vector for this collection of spins is the sum over all possible, after the bath starts interacting with it and the gravitational interaction, will be the sum of the various possible spin states you can have multiplied by the bath states, multiplied by some coefficients. And I want to expand this in eigenstates of total spin, because that's what I'm going to identify W with, and so this is what you get. Now, the density matrix, I know something about the density matrix because this is a thermal. I've assumed that the spins are thermalized. So if I trace this over this pure state over the bath states, where you get essentially the spin states times the absolute magnitude of c squared, that should be the Boltzmann term. So that's the Boltzmann term here, where alpha is all these, it's either minus beta h, and so this is beta h here. And it's a standard problem to work out what those sums are. And so you get the c squared, you get the scalar product of pi with s for this particular little volume over that particular time only, which is of this form. And if alpha is small, and if you put numbers into this thing, alpha will be small, this is what you get here. You get a Gaussian, because that's why I did this, because I know that the sum of independent things gives you a Gaussian, I want a Gaussian. And so if you take all spins, so this is the spins over all possible volumes, and over all the time intervals that are involved, you get the sum of such terms, and they look like this, and then you can factor out things, and the n here becomes an n squared divided by the n, you get a delta ft delta t, this is the spins over n, the average spin, identify this thing with w, this thing, you need those little constants there to get the a exactly as I defined it, and this is a thing that should be equal to 1. And I won't go into actually putting some numbers, and I put the Planck time, the Planck temperature in, and the 3-degree body, black body temperature in, and I can fiddle with it so that the number's fine. But anyway, that's the model, okay? Now, these are not very reasonable models, perhaps, but I hope they give you an idea of the kind of thing I need. If there's somebody or more than one person here who has some ideas what to do, I would how to actually get a really good physical thing to be there for W of T, to replace W of T, I'd like to talk to you. Okay, so that's the end of my talk about the first paper, and I can, in the time remaining to me, discuss the second paper, which it will not be as extensive a discussion. First of all, what's wrong with relativistic collapse models, which I've been working on for so long? Well, the first thing that you could do is just generalize the CSL evolution, make it relativistic. So 0 to T gets replaced by two hypersurfaces, W becomes a scalar, Lorentz scalar, and A, some kind of quantum field. It has to be a quantum scalar field, it could be just a scalar field, or side by side might be gold for like mass density, something like that. But immediately you run into a problem. The problem is that the W of X, this is classical white noise I'm talking about now. I'm not talking about the completely quantized collapse theory, I'm back to classical CSL and classical field. It has all frequencies and wave numbers in it. And what that does is it excites each possible mode in the vacuum that can be excited. So if you have a quantum field theory of electrons, it's going to excite all the possible moments of electrons. A little bit, excites each of them just a little bit, not a lot. But unfortunately, there are an infinite number of these modes. And so the number of modes is infinite, and so you end up with actually infinite energy per second unit volume of vacuum excitation. The vacuum just gets too excited. Behind this, the collapse mechanism works fine, but this is unacceptable, it doesn't do with experiment. So I tried this. I generalized this to a little colored noise model, which is that this is the form of the Gaussian. This will actually cause collapse. And what you find is that I made the momentum energy spectrum of this function g of x prime a tachyonic spectrum with tachyon mass mu. Why did I do that? Because there ain't no tachyons, I suppose. I'm assuming that there are not any tachyons. So there aren't any tachyon modes to be excited. And it turns out very nicely that these K0, K relationship, this is responsible for collapse. It is the, if you will, the tachyonic relationship between momentum and energy, which is responsible for collapse. It's the radionic, the usual one, which is responsible for excitation. So you can get away with this. Well, you can get away with this in first order. It doesn't excite the vacuum in first order. But alas, in second order it does. Again, you get infinite vacuum excitation for a second unit volume. And the reason for that is if you do a Feynman calculation, diagram calculation, just the second order, they involve internal lines of the particles. And you have a propagator there. And the propagator has all possible relationships and allows all possible K0K values. So once again, you're getting this excitation. So I took a drastic cure. I removed the time ordering from the evolution. When you do that, the propagator becomes on shell. And there is no longer this excitation from the vacuum. Of course, there's a price to pay, and it's a heavy price to pay, because time ordering makes sure that things go forward in time. But if you don't have time ordering, things go forward in time and then go backwards in time. And that can give you non-local behavior. It does give you non-local behavior. So it can have non-local behavior. I was willing to live with that for a while, but I just recently discovered the killer for me. We can call this first one the relativistic CSL1, this one relativistic CSL2. The killer for me is both the first order calculations of excitation of nucleons out of the nucleus are the same. The time ordering doesn't play any role in that, it turns out. And it's just too much. It's just too much. There's an experiment performed by Frank Avignoni where he puts a slab of germanium in between two terminals and he looks for radiation coming out of it. He's been doing this for maybe 15 to 20 years, and every 5 years the reason he's doing this changes. Right now he's looking for whips. What he's looking for is for a whip to hit germanium and knock something out, and then this is a particle detector using the germanium's back bias a little bit, and so we can actually see pulses. And he's looking, he's got very low noise set up, it's in a mine and all that. And in particular, the germanium 74, which is around 30% of the germanium that's in there, has a 0 plus to 2 plus, this is the first excited state, 0.596 MeV level. And in that bin, as in most of the bins, is a very small count, 0.03 counts per kilogram per day. He's been looking for a year at these things. So,
that's an upper limit? Or is
this is an upper limit, yeah. Experimental upper limit.
It's consistent in that energy, in that dip. It's consistent with zero.
It's consistent with zero. Perfectly consistent with zero, exactly. Now, if you calculate the excitation rate of a nucleon out of a nucleus or an electron out of an atom, you find because of mass proportionality, it turns out that the lowest order term, which is an expansion, you can do an expansion of the excitation rate in powers of the size of the structure, like the atomic size, divided by 10 to the minus 2 centimeters per an array. And the first term, which goes in that ratio squared, vanishes identically because of the mass proportionality. And that is one of the reasons for assuming mass proportionality. It's the evidence for mass proportionality. It's pretty good now. Yeah. So the next term is a quadrupole excitation, A over to the fourth, size over A to the fourth. And you can work it out for standard CSL, and you get this quadrupole matrix element. And you can work it out for the true relativistic theories, and you get this matrix element, and it's much bigger. And the reason is, you have this K to the fifth here, times A, where here you have over A to the fourth. And K is much larger number than 10 to the fifth. It's 10 to the fifth times larger, and you get five powers of it. The reason you get this is that in a Galilean invariant theory, the momentum transfer to a particle is h bar of a constant, A, and it's the same in all Galilean frames. And that's Galilean invariant. But in a relativistic theory with tachyonic energy exchange, it's not. K squared is equal to this is the mass squared, 1 over A squared is the mass squared of the tachyon, that's the way I've chosen it, it's not one electron volt, two electrons for the mass, plus the energy squared. In the normal theory, it's the energy squared is the mass squared plus K squared, here it's K squared is equal to the A minus 2 mass squared, and it's just too darn big. Now, what I'm lucky about is that this matrix element appears because this is exactly the quadrupole matrix element. It appears in the calculation of the lifetime of the state. So I can relate, I can find, replace R by the lifetime and some other parameters. And what you find is for CSL, 10 to the minus 15 counts per kilogram per day, but for the relativistic theories, 10 to the 11 counts per kilogram. So the theories are simply out. Here's a kind of a list that I've made of CSL. The only bad thing about it is it's not relativistically invariant as far as it's concerned. The relativistic models, they just don't agree with experiment. This is the experiment, they don't agree. And so what I'm going to present you with in the last few transparencies is a quasi-relativistic model, which is the best that I can do, which, okay, it's not exactly relativistically invariant, but it almost is. It's not exactly local, but it almost is, but by God, it agrees with experiment. That's very nice. And it reduces to ordinary CSL with a non-relativistic limit. And since that's very nicely tested, Why shouldn't, but I'm going with this. So here's the evolution, the standard evolution. It looks relative to the invariant. But I'm going to choose for A the analogy of the number operator, the non-relativistic number operator. That is to say, for the non-relativistic number operator is the creation operator times the annihilation operator. Here I'm going to choose the negative frequency of the part of the scalar field times the positive frequency part of the scalar field. This is what the negative frequency part of the scalar field is. It is a relativistic invariant. It transforms relativistically like a relativistic scalar. And so the product transforms like a relativistic scalar. This thing is formally a Lorentz scalar, but it's not a relativistically invariant evolution. And the reason it's not a relativistically invariant evolution is this thing does not commute with itself at space-like separation. So what is time ordering in one reference frame, when I go to another reference frame, it has to use the time ordering in the first frame. Because I define this essentially really in one frame. So you might as well make a 0 to t in one reference frame, and then you go to any other frame, but I must use the time ordering. So it's not relativistically invariant evolution. But it almost is, because while the operators here, so this is what AX, I'm giving you some example what A of X is. In CSL, this is just the expression I wrote down before. And what I'm using here is a trick from non-local quantum field theories. I guess Pius de Leeuwenhoek is one of the first papers about this, but Evimov did a lot of work on this. It's exactly analogous, but you see what I've got here is a Gaussian in B vector, and it's not minus P0 squared, it's plus P0 squared, so I can actually do this integral, but the time addition here is imaginary over here. But it's exactly the same as that. And why do I say it's quasi-relativistic? Because it almost commutes. That is, you take this this operator A over here and you form its commutator, and this is what you get, and it's equal essentially to the integral over these B's, which are all Gaussians, and a commutator of phi plus and phi minus. Now the commutator of phi plus and phi minus is this, where z is this. And what you can see here is that where the Gaussian is large, where the b's and b0's, that's where they're close to A. And when they're close to A, this is of the order of A. But what's the argument of K is, this is a very large number. And K exponentially decays with its argument, and M is, for a nucleon, is 10 to the minus 14, and A is 10 to the minus 5th, so it goes to the minus 10 to the 9th, which is very small. So if you get far from the particles, this almost collapses. I'm sorry, almost commutes. And so that's what I mean by quasi-relativistic. Well, very rapidly, this is my last transparency. You'd expect from its construction that it would give you sensible results, and it does. This is just here, so just show you what I can do the calculations. If you have a superposition of two particles, you can calculate the collapse rate, and it's this very complicated looking expression. But if you make the approximation that 10 to the 9th is very, very much greater than 1, this becomes the CSL collapse rate. And the energy creation rate for n2 particles, again, it's a complicated looking expression, but if you make the same approximation, you get this. It was interesting, when I first started working on relativistic collapse models, I was out at Berkeley and was talking with Henry Stapp about this, and he remarked to me, well, he wasn't worried if I couldn't make a good, I was talking about the problems of relativistic collapse models 10 years ago. He wasn't worried about whether I could make a relativistic model or not, because he thought the collapse would take place in the co-moving plane of the universe. And I was amazed, so that's why I remembered it, because he's this guy who spent a lot of his life doing relativistic quantum field theory, and he wouldn't worry about whether I could make a relativistic quantum field theory. That was remarkable. This is the best I can do. The reason I'm doing this is because the world around us looks relativistic. This theory has to be tested in various ways, other than the CSL test. For example, fast-moving apparatuses or something like that may give a dramatically different prediction. I don't know to look at this kind of stuff. But it looks like it would predict what looks like relativistic behavior locally and class behavior locally. And perhaps the preferred frame is the cosmological full-moving frame. I don't have anything to say about it. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, just to echo this last point, I think it's been, some of us said this to you before, there's now a lot of interest from people in quantum gravity about experimental test cycle and invariance in various contexts. And if the message of the work is if you want to make sense of quantum mechanics this way, you lose the exact relativistic invariance, but you can get it back approximately, then maybe there are predictions that you can make for things like what's happening in synchrotron radiation, and that just to make some of people a sensitive test that I'm going to do very, very high energy cosmic rays.
I'd like to talk a little bit more so you could tell me a little bit more about the suggested things so I can apply this and see in fact what kind of prediction it makes. And also, you could let me know about but other people, I know you mentioned to me last year, but I hadn't looked at it. I'd like to know what kind of experimental tests people are proposing.